You're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review. On today's episode, episode number 289, entitled, How to Figure Out Your Purpose and Have More Meaning in Life, I chat with Nate Novosel. Nate Novosel is a professional researcher and advisor with over 20 years of experience studying individual and group behavior. In today's episode, Nate talks about his new book called The Meaning of Life, A Guide to Finding Your Life's Purpose. He discusses the truth about happiness and about our purpose in life as human beings and why so many people mess both of these things up so badly. He covers the 8 universal factors that underlie our sense of meaning and purpose and breaks down each for us to understand. If you're wondering how to identify your life's purpose and how to be happier during your time on Earth, check this episode out now. You are going to love it. Have you guys been on EliteLifeNutrition.com lately? If not, make sure you check it out right now because we have all of our incredible products up there right now for you to order. Our incredible men's multivitamin, women's multivitamin, B-complex, turmeric curcumin, resveratrol, magnesium, zinc, calcium, NAC, ashwagandha, our incredible sleep formula, milk thistle, ginkgo biloba, lemon balm, glutamine, lithium orotate, tyrosine, all of our products are on our website right now, as well as our incredible featured bundles. The men's essentials bundle, women's essentials bundle, brain support, liver support, mineral support, immune system, elite antioxidant bundle. We've packaged so many of our incredible bundles together for you to check out. And right now, if you order over $75 worth of product, you get free shipping, as well as the buy in bulk where you order 2, you get 5% off, you order 4 or more, you get 10% off, you order 12 or more, and you get 15% off that individual product. There are so many different ways to save money at EliteLifeNutrition.com. And so many ways to make sure you optimize your health and live an elite life. So make sure you go to EliteLifeNutrition.com right now and check out our incredible products. We have the best supplements in the world, and we want to share those with you today. EliteLifeNutrition.com. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from Elite Man Magazine, and my guest today is Nate Novosel, the author of the newest book called, I want to get this right, The Meaning of Life, A Guide to Finding Your Life's Purpose. Nate, thanks so much for coming on the show, man.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited, man. I mean, I honestly haven't been able to go through the book yet, but I had, I think your sister or somebody reached out. We were in contact for the past few weeks, and I'm excited to set this interview up because I think the book is really interesting. The topics of the book, I have like a lot of the notes and stuff, and I want to dig into exactly why you wrote the book and what it's really about, but I think I have a good understanding of it. But can you just take literally a minute or so and talk about what it is you do as a professional researcher and a writer now, obviously author, and kind of what that actually means?
Sure. So I've been doing research and advisory for the world's leading executives for over 16 years now. And I've been studying everything from human behavior and psychology to, you know, organizational best practices, and even like evolutionary psychology, biology type fields, really just trying to understand how things work and how to optimize them. But what was interesting about 7 years ago when I actually started writing the book was that I'd studied psychology, human behavior, and how to succeed at life for so long and read so many books that I asked myself, you know, what would I explain to someone else if they didn't read 100 books or 200 books or how many books I read? How would I explain how it all worked so that they could master their life? And that's how the book came to be.
Cool. So when we're talking about research for different companies and stuff, like what types of things were you actually doing? You said like psychology and stuff, but what would they like hire you to do as a job?
Yeah, so in research and advisory, basically what we do is organizations have major challenges, right? You know, or organizations are continuing to evolve, new technologies are discovered and invented and so forth. So what they come to us for is say, hey, look, what are my peers doing and how can I improve as I'm a leader of my function, you know, function in an organization like IT or HR or finance. And what we do is we go and we'd have hundreds of conversations with organizations and everyone had the same problem. So we would just ask them, you know, what their challenge was, what they were doing about it, and we would find the organizations that solved the challenge that no one else could figure out because they thought about the world differently or thought about the problem differently. And we would dissect what it was that everyone else was getting wrong. And then we would help, we call it a reframe, but it's a way of us telling the other leaders that, hey, here's how you're thinking about it wrong. And if you change your mindset on this and you do it this way instead, you'll solve your problem.
Cool. So this sort of philosophy that you had over the years is what led you into writing this latest book of figuring out like why so many people are unhappy today. So many people are depressed. They have all these problems. They're going about life a certain way with a certain mindset, where it's like you can kind of see it from that sort of background experience you have, and it's like they're missing a key thing here or there, and if they look at it this way, they start living their life a certain way, they can really see some change.
You're absolutely right. My work as a research advisor really colored my entire worldview, and I started seeing everything as, you know, everybody thinks it's that, but it's not that. It's really this other thing. They're getting it wrong. And that combined with my personal experience, so just some background on me, when I was 5, my father disappeared in the middle of the night. Well, I don't remember, because I was too young then to remember how I actually reacted to that. I know that I did go and see him about a year later, and when I came back, I felt this sense of emptiness and hopelessness and worthlessness that I wouldn't wish on anybody. And so that's when I first asked the question, well, what's the point of all this? I'm miserable. This sucks. And the funny thing is that, you know, most people ponder that, but in the back of my mind, I'm just like, you know, I bet you can answer that. So I was like, challenge accepted. And I'm 6 years old. So I spent decades studying, not just doing the research advisory for a living, but then also my personal time, I'd study psychology and all these other fields, even, you know, self-help, everything, trying to figure out what the answers were. And it turned out that when I asked myself, how would I explain it to somebody else, I was like, well, you know, there are all these different philosophies, but, you know, they're actually all based on the same 8 core concepts that have to be addressed in any philosophy. And they're based not just on philosophy and good principles and religion and all these other things, but they're also supported by science. And I was like, holy crap, I just stumbled upon something amazing. So it took me 7 years to write the book because I kept rewriting it to get it right. But the idea that there's a philosophy that's backed by science is just an absolutely amazing idea. And so that's what caused me to write it.
So basically, was this idea that like your father left at say 5 or 6 years old, was that the driving force, the motivator, like your constant purpose to figure out this problem at such an early age, and that was the motivator of your actions thereafter? Or was it more just like a background thing in the back of your mind and you kind of went about your life, but it was always sort of there lingering around?
Yeah. So it was always in the back of my mind, really. I mean, I was always trying to learn how to do things well, how to succeed at life. You know, I always wanted to, you know, be the perfect child for my single mother. So I did the best that I could, and I kept learning about behavior and how, you know, things worked and how the world worked. And it wasn't until I actually learned enough and did research and advisory for years that I finally asked myself the question of like, well, if I would explain it to someone else, I would say it this way and hear all the things that people usually get wrong. And it started coming to me that, oh my God, I actually have something to say, something unique, something different. And it was then that I said, well, that's, you know, I love my job, but at the same time, like, I was like, I want to advise on something that really is impactful, something that's mine. And when that happened, it came together and I said, oh, that's it. I got to write this book.
So let's dive into the book a bit. So you mentioned the 8 sort of tenets of the book, and the one sort of, link between all philosophies, whether Eastern philosophy, Western philosophy, of the meaning of life, happiness, like the truth behind things. And so what are those things? What are the 8 core things that you discovered?
Yeah, so this is going to be a while, but just give me a few minutes here. So the meaning of life.
How about we rattle them off just real quick so guys can write them down, and then we can just kind of dive into more of them in depth.
That sounds good. Okay, so the 8 are this, and feel free to write these down. Growth, experience, desire, belief, emotions, ethics, support, choice.
Perfect.
So those are the 8 things.
Cool.
So here's a little bit about how those come together. So the meaning of life is growth. So that's scientifically proven. I mean, Darwin, you know, supported that when he talked about survival of the fittest. The thing that's unsaid, but it has to be true for survival of the fittest to be true, is you have to have a drive to live. And, you know, everyone talks about survival and they talk about reproduction, but they don't realize that there's that part. What is reproduction? It's growth. It's a form of growth. So yeah. Growth is scientifically proven to be the drive that every human being and every living organism has. But you can also get philosophical and take that leap and say, well, maybe that is the point of life, is you're here to live and grow. Well, but how do you do that? Well, you do it through experience. Experience is a medium through which all growth occurs. I mean, you know, you could go read a book. That is an experience, but it's also you learn more if you have more of that experience by actually going and doing it. So you grow through experience. That's the point, whether it's professionally or with your family or whatever you're doing. That's the point, and that's how it's done. But there are those six other items. They all factor into, well, what areas do you grow in, and how much do you grow by, and what, how do you change direction and do all those other things. So, well, we can keep going, but I'll pause there if that makes sense so far.
Yeah, so the first two are growth and experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, diving into that, it's like, do all the other ones sort of fall in line afterwards? Like, those are the two initial ones. Is it sort of like in sequential order, like you got to kind of do one after the other, or is it just like randomly, like this is a powerful one, but it doesn't really connect to the next thing?
Well, they build on each other. The way that I wrote the book is that once you understand the first one, it allows you to understand the second, allows you to understand the third and how it relates. They all are interrelated, so you can use them all kind of at the same time. But the way that I wrote the book is at the end of each chapter, there's a kind of set of questions and exercises to actually take action on the concept. So, for example, at the end of the growth areas, it says, well, list areas that you would like to be better in. So, like, list growth areas, right? Experiences are, well, take those growth areas, identify things you could do tomorrow that would allow you to grow in those areas. And then step three, this is the desire piece. So desire is that drive. It's the internal motivation you have to have experiences that lead to growth, or the desire you have for a certain outcome that requires growth to get to. You know, nobody wants – so you have things that you want that you don't have. That's desire. You have things that you want that you do have. That's appreciation. So there has to be, by definition, in life, something you don't have that you want that you need to grow into. That's why that's the point of life. And desire is that driving force that tells you, okay, I want this, so I'm going to go after it. So you could argue, well, desire, well, it would be nice to know that – it's nice to know the concept of desire when you define your growth areas, because you have to define growth areas where you want to grow. But in terms of helping understand each concept in detail, I have to do it in that order. Seems to be the most logical.
Which is the one after desire?
Belief. To get what you want, it requires those two core things, desire and belief. Desire is the driving force. Belief is the sustaining force. So you can want something more than you want anything in the entire world. But if you don't believe you can get it, doesn't matter. You won't do it, because you're like, well, I'm not going to waste my time if I'm not going to get it. So belief is what's required to sustain your desire through adversity. Is the core of it. Now, there are a lot of other components of belief, right, that beliefs help you to understand the world accurately so you do the right things. There's also the idea of faith, which is basically just the belief of a positive outcome without evidence. And you actually need that, because otherwise, if you needed evidence for literally everything, then, you know, I'd be living like I wasn't going to live tomorrow, because I don't have evidence that I'm going to be alive tomorrow. So therefore, you know, you could take that to its extreme and get a little nuts. So you need belief.
Yeah. It sounds like the belief one is kind of related to hope too. And I think hope is sometimes it's overrated factor. And, you know, people think, you know, kind of throw the hope word out there and it's this and that to them. But I think it can be very profound, and because it really generates a lot of inspiration and then, of course, energy to get things done in life. And if you don't have that belief or hope, then you're not going to be able to actually get those things, like do the actions, take the actions that you need to take daily to get the things that you want. And then, of course, that goes back to some of the other ones that we're talking about here, of like growth and experience. And, you know, I think they are all kind of connected in a way. I don't know if they're directly related to each other, but you got to have like one to have the other. And it makes sense to me. Does hope sort of factor in that? Is that you kind of?
Yeah, hope is a synonym for faith or for belief in the outcome. There are nuanced differences. We don't need to go into them now. But yeah, hope is basically the expectation of a positive outcome. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And when we're talking about growth anyways, we're talking about experience, like this whole conversation really too isn't like you need to it's not like Darwin's like, what was it, like three – I don't even know if it was Darwin. What are the three – or is it more than that? I'm completely lost here, drawing a blank. But there's like essential things that you have to do to as an organism to survive. This isn't like survival stuff we're talking about here, needless to say. I think there's six maybe essential
You're referring survival. To like food and water and sleep yes, and exactly. shelter and exactly. love this, and that sort of thing?
Yeah. Is there six of those? That's six. Or seven.
I'm sure we could think of six.
You can make up a million, but
yeah, it's food, water, sleep, sex, air,
reproduction, I think is one.
Love for social animals, love, belonging. That's six.
Yeah. Okay.
Sure. Cool. Why not?
Fills the need now anyways. But so we're not talking about the survival here. We're actually talking about happiness, which to many people is obviously a more important thing. Like, we don't want to just survive on this planet. We don't want to just live and, you know, breathe air. We want to actually enjoy life. And that's really what the core, I think, takeaway from the book is. It's not just how to like survive, and because anybody can just live. I mean, insects and, you know, rodents and everybody exists, but what is our actual meaning to being here? And I think it's a lot deeper when we're talking about what, you know, some of these core tenets, the eight tenets that you have, as opposed to just like the survival ones of Darwin, whoever came up with that list.
Yeah. So it's really interesting you say that, because the next one is emotions, right after belief. And a lot of people believe that the meaning of life is happiness or to be happy. You know, a lot of people correct that and say it's what makes you happy, which is more accurate. That's one of my biggest reframes or contrarian points in the book, is the meaning of life is not to be happy. Because if that were true, they actually have done studies. They've hooked it up to electrodes up to the brains of rats. They've hooked up electrodes to the brains of humans. And you could experience bliss, eternal bliss, for the rest of your short life when you die of starvation because you don't want to do anything else. So you could be happy for the rest of your life right now with the technology we have. And that doesn't necessarily make your life meaningful or fulfilling. It just makes it blissful. So you can hack your brain. You can take drugs or all kinds of things. So happiness is not the meaning of life. It's not the point. It's the signal. It's the feedback. It's the indicator that you're growing. So if you eat a good, nutritious meal and you feel happy, you're like, oh, yeah, why? That's your body say, good job, way to eat that food, because now I'm going to be able to grow. That's what it's telling you. Now, you can hack that too, but anything can be – any indicator can be cheated, right? Like, you know, if you go to school, do you go to – one of my favorite questions is, do you go to school to learn or you go to school to get an A? And you say you go to school to learn, but once you start getting graded, you go to school to get an A. You no longer go to school necessarily to learn. You teach to the test and all that jazz. Same thing with happiness. If you say the meaning of life is happiness, then you go after happiness. You don't go after growth, which leads to happiness, or is the real thing you're going after.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So do you have a problem with the way like our kids are taught in school? I mean, I won't go off on this tangent, but there is a whole failure in the education system in this country of, there's so many high school, like in major cities right now, New York, Chicago, Baltimore, where there's like multiple high schools where there isn't a single student that can pass a literacy test in reading or math, which is, for one, it's a shame. It's also very sad. But beside that point, as far as like what you mentioned, which is a good point, I believe, like, what are we actually going, and not even just education per se or students, but like across different fields, like even our work, our jobs and different things we come across, like, you know, we're trying to learn a skill or whatever. At some point, our mind shifts from actually wanting to learn something to learn it and actually enjoy it to just being able to like be good at the grading part of that thing. And I think there's a disconnect there, and it throws off our reason for why we're actually doing it or think we want to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, Daniel Pink. Are you familiar with Daniel Pink, who wrote Drive?
Yeah, I've heard the name. Yeah.
At least I hope. I hope that's him. I always get Daniel Pink and Daniel Gilbert and Daniel Ariely mixed up. They're all.
I thought there was a Pinkner too. Isn't there a Pinkner out there somewhere?
Steven Pinker. Pinker, yeah. I actually reached out to him with the book. He wrote back to me. He's a nice guy. So Daniel Pink, I believe it was, who wrote Drive, said you need three things to self-motivate once you get money and stuff out of the way. He talked about – it was like mastery, autonomy, and I'm always blank on the third one. But there are three. And he kind of got at the point that at some point extrinsic motivation actually demotivates you. and makes you worse, perform worse. And that you need intrinsic motivation. And that's what the three things were about. Because mastery, you have an intrinsic motivation to be better at something. Notice the tie to growth there. See, all the philosophies and all the even scientific research can tie back to some form of growth, which is cool. But the autonomy of being able to, you know, have self, that's choice, right? You're self-determining your own destiny. So he mentioned that you need these things. And most people, they try to reward you with money and external pressures to get you to want to do it. But it actually backfires and makes you less motivated and makes you less willing. So there's a lot of that. I don't know how to solve the school system with that insight. I'm not going to try. But I do think that there are two issues. One is that I do feel like – have you heard of the crisis of meaning that people talk about these days, that people just feel like they're floating around and they don't really feel like they have a purpose?
I haven't necessarily heard of that, but I know that's accurate, yes.
So generally what I found is that the better the world gets, the more sensitive people get to any little slight that happens. I mean, you're seeing that today with our very polarized world.
PC culture and everything.
Yeah, is that people get sensitive about everything. It's like, well, I mean, look, yeah, you should always strive to be better. That's the whole point, you know, growth.
Yeah.
But like at the same time, it's like people are getting less able to really kind of – be the best versions of themselves, right? So if you live in a world that's – I mean, look, I told you my background. I didn't grow up wealthy by any means. I'm glad – I'm proud of that, and I'm glad for that because it taught me to appreciate money. It taught me to appreciate hard work. It taught me to appreciate all these things. But there are a lot of people who are growing up and everything, you know, the helicopter parents or whatever, and things are handed to them in the sense that like if they want something, they don't want for anything. They get what they need at all times. And if their grades are bad, then they get yelled at their parents yell at their teachers or whatever. Like whatever happens to make them get through and keep going, that they don't have that like drive that really gets them like, I need to do this for myself. I need to take responsibility for my life. I need to go and I don't want to go after something just to go after it. So I think that's one problem. I don't know how to answer that or solve that, but I think that's one issue causing a lot of problems in schools is that people just kind of float around because there's other, you know, there are no bears trying to kill you. So it's like, okay, well, you know, I'm going to live. I just need to sit here in this class until they tell me to go. So there's no real drive or push for a lot of folks to really do that. And then the other thing I would argue is yeah, I do think there's some weird incentives going on across the board. Again, I don't have any answers, so I don't want to criticize. I'm just observing that that we need to figure out how to fix these incentives because it's really just you're teaching the test. You don't really care about learning. There's no real like passion or pursuit of intellectual pursuits for just for the sake of doing it. It's all about letters and numbers and getting in the right schools and knowing the right people. And you're right, it's no longer the point to get better and to grow and to learn, but it's rather to satisfy some people's requirement to hit a certain benchmark.
Yeah, I think it's a terrible tragedy and a big problem, especially with that younger generation in this country and probably many other countries I'm not familiar with, but I'm sure. But it's you know, there's a number of things going on, but for sure, like what you mentioned of taking responsibility, not having things handed to you in life, and being able to accept the fact that things will happen in your life, and then when they come your way, you got to take responsibility for how you react to those things. Like those things are always going to be there in life. They're always going to pop up. There's always going to be obstacles and setbacks. But when you're catered your entire life, especially as children, especially nowadays, it's worse than ever. Like it's gone up dramatically with the parenting. And I think it's a big problem. I think a big part of it comes from the problem with the parenting and just the way that things have gone. But if you have all these kids that are sheltered and then of course they become adults, and they're no longer sheltered anymore, but they've lived their entire lives with that fallback safety net. When stuff comes their way in life, they're going to have absolutely no idea how to react to it and how to handle it. And oftentimes that's the case, that you look across the board, all these, you know, 20-something kids getting out of college or, you know, in that sort of range, the younger millennial type of range, like a lot of them are suffering right now. A lot of them are struggling right now. You know, a lot of them are living in their mother's basements because – you know, they don't know how to actually go out and provide for themselves and take care of themselves. But, you know, that, again, that's kind of a different topic. We can probably go on and on about that. But I do think there's a lot to what you're saying here. There's a lot of good information. And another point that came up as well is like what's driving people, what's motivating people. Daniel, I believe his name's Daniel Kahneman. You probably heard of him, researcher. He came up with something a few years back where it was like 75,000 is like the number that people have to hit. It might be a little bit more now, you know, with inflation and stuff, the economy goes up. But it was like 75,000 is the number. And anything after that, as far as like making annual money, income, anything over 75K and you're good, like you're not going to be much happier than someone who's already, like once you had, basically his point is once you have a certain level of a, income coming in where you can safely have money to have shelter, food, water, etc., you don't really need much more than that. And people think like, oh, I got to make more money. I got to work more hours. I got to do this. I got to do that. It's always like a grind to make more money. When realistically, if you look at the statistics, and this was like a huge research thing that he did, the number really isn't that much. It's like you just need to provide. You got to be safe. You got to be safe and you got to be comfortable. But after that, you don't need to be a super millionaire, multi, you know, 10 million networked kind of guy to be happier. Like the actually, the, you know, they've done studies where if the more money you make because you're spending less time in other areas of your life, which, you know, the meaningful parts of life, a lot of these guys that make a lot of money are some of the most unhappy guys out of all.
Yeah. Well, that's some of the stuff I talk about in the book are all the trade-offs that you have to make. So let's talk about two. Let's talk about one that we were just talking about with the kids. Let's take choice. And I can explain choice a little bit as well. We can get through these. choice is the idea that ultimately you have agency, that you have the ability to make decisions. There are things you cannot control in this world. There are things you can control in this world. And so your destiny is a sum of your choices. Yes, other things will happen and they might shape your destiny. They might not. It's up to you to do what you can do within your control to make your life what you want it to be. So I mean, that's ultimately, and props to my wife. She was the one who I had seven and she said, well, what about choice? And, you know, I think that's important to mention that everyone has a choice. And I was like, oh crap! How did I miss that? You know,
shit, I missed one.
but anyway, so let's talk about that. So when you're a kid, and so I think what the thing that's broken with being raised as a child is there's actually a trade-off between freedom and responsibility. And that trade-off has existed for since the beginning of time, and it exists now. But they've kind of broken it, right? Like you're supposed to get older, and you're supposed to have more freedom, right? You can do what you want, you can stay out late or whatever. But you have responsibility, right? You have to work, or you have to, you know, whatever. You do good to school, or whatever the thing is. But I feel like that's been broken somewhere. I jokingly call it spoiled teenager syndrome, but that's just a joke. To say that, like, I want all the freedoms, but I don't want any of the responsibility. And I think there's something broken there that people talk about freedom, but no one talks about responsibility that comes with the freedom. And it's just everything's broken with that because it's like, yeah, you know, freedom is unsafe. People think that you can have freedom and safety, but those are trade-offs too. So the more safe you are, the less free you are, right? You can put up a wall and be more safe from the bear coming, trying to come at you, but then you're less free because you can't go past the wall. You have to climb over the wall or go through the door or do whatever. You are less free. And good people point. Just can't – they're willing to sacrifice everything for safety, or they think freedom is somehow freedom. They say, oh, I'm free to do these things, but they're really saying they're safe to do these things. And it's just all these trade-offs that people won't acknowledge exist and that are being kind of, because they're kind of being broken recently where kids can just grow up and as long as they're safe, everything's about safety. But then it's like, well, now I want freedom. And it's like, well, the more free you are, the less safe you are. The more free you are, the more responsibility you have. And you're not willing to take any responsibility, but yet you want all this freedom. And it's just so broken. So I look. I don't have answers. I have identification of the problem, but I do see that as one of the big issues that as folks really try to figure out their way in the world. And that's why people like Jordan Peterson and all those folks who are like, you know, make your bed and, you know, do all that, stand up straight and all that other stuff. They're teaching people responsibility because no one else is having that conversation because no one's helping them be more responsible.
Yeah, and you think about something like that, you're like, wow, that's the stupidest thing in the world, making your bed or getting up at, say, 5 in the morning, like Jocko will mention, things like that. And it's like, those are the dumbest, like, stupidest little things, but at the same time, and you do that every single day, it goes a long way, especially when you have a broken system of not developing this responsibility over the years. You have, like, decades of growth where there's no real responsibility, no accountability, no accounting for the things that you do every day. And then it's like these kids are missing all this stuff and they don't develop that skill because it's a skill like anything else until you know, they actually never really develop it, and then they fall flat on their face and they're wondering why life sucks and it's so hard, and then, you know, they get depressed and accept, you know, jump on medication, and some of them don't make it. I wrote a book, Elite Mind, I told you back before we jumped on the call back in January, and it's all about the it's all about anxiety, depression, and then of course suicides, and there's there's a ridiculous amount of suicides, and it, especially right now with the pandemic going on. I heard a statistic last week, the numbers jumped up 600%, and it's like many of these suicides are younger kids. They're in their 18, you know, 24 year old range. And it's sad because, you know, we think that, you know, why would this person ever do that? Why would anyone, like, and then it's like, you look at their conditioning for 20 years and then it's like, that's why they did that, because we failed them as parents, as adults, as peers, as, you know, community leaders. We didn't actually show them the things that they needed, like you mentioned, the doing your bed in the morning when you wake up, or the waking up at 5 a.m, or doing the chores, or, you know, having responsibilities in the morning to get things done. We have all these freedoms you've given these kids, and they don't know what the hell to do with it.
Yeah, and I do think, if I had one recommendation for people with parents, now I don't have kids, so don't take this as like I know parenting, but just my knowledge of science and psychology is that there's a trade-off. Or something that comes together. More freedom you have, the more responsibility you have. So if some people are asking for more freedom, make sure it's associated with more responsibility, or you will break that. You know, those things are supposed to come together, and you'll break the kid's mind in terms of thinking that, oh, I just get all this freedom, I don't have to do anything. Because once they get to the real world and realize that everything you have to work for and everything requires a lot of responsibility, and you're accountable, and you will be, you know, held responsible if you do anything wrong or mess up or don't take care of yourself, it's really tragic. The other thing that you mentioned, I want to get back to the other one, was that you mentioned that once you make a certain amount of money that you're not any happier. And it's a really good point, because what I mentioned in the book in the growth area is the reason why growth is the only unifying meaning that we can identify across all philosophies and religions is because people disagree on what type of growth to get. Like religions, it's like, well, you should live with God, and people who say it's not growth, it's living living in by God's will. I say, okay, well, tomorrow, do you want to live more by God's will or less by God's will? It's like, I'm not against you. You're welcome to do it. I have no doubt. Is that people disagree on the type of growth. Spiritual growth is fine. I put it in the book. I'm not one way or the other. I try to keep it neutral, just to let people know that I'm okay if you believe. I'm okay if you don't believe. I'm trying to unify atheists and theists together around a common set of principles, and I'm failing miserable. I'm upsetting everybody. But so there are different forms of growth. And because of that, you only have so much time in the day, so much time in your life, you have trade-offs. So yeah, you can work for more money, but at some point you can earn millions of dollars. You know, if you have $20 billion and you don't have – you could spend, you know, $1 million every day for the rest of your life, and then you'll die, you'll still be rich. Then there has to be something else. And so you're just always making trade-offs between the growth areas. There's, you know, monetary gain, there's family, there's friends, there's just learning a skill or a hobby, and you just got to make those decisions. So you're right that the reason why happiness trails off is because earning more money isn't necessarily helping you achieve your financial goals, because at some point your financial goals are just to earn you enough money to live. And if you're doing more earning than you are living, then you start to actually feel even worse, I would argue.
Yeah, I would say the same exact thing. And yeah, it's kind of funny how money's a weird thing. Like it's almost like an addictive thing, like a gambler's type of thing. Once you get a little bit of it, a taste of it, it's like you want more and more of it. And I think a lot of people fall into that trap, unfortunately. And then the way our culture is, you know, just our music is like that. Our TV shows are like that. Our friends and like everybody, we all value money in such a high regard here, and especially in America, it's like there's a lot more to life than money. And I think a lot of people have just been conditioned over time to just have money at the highest, and there's so many other things below it that, you know, they place in their minds that are actually more important than money. And, you know, like you and I agree on this, I think there's a point where it's very important, then after that it's like, all right, I've gotten to that level, now I want to really figure out what the meaning of life is. Because obviously I think everybody can agree that the meaning of life isn't becoming a millionaire or becoming a billionaire, you know what I mean? Like everybody can agree that that's not why we're put on this, to make a certain amount of dollars on this planet. Like there's a lot more to it. And I think most people just don't even ask that question. They kind of get blinded and lost in the shuffle of life, where they're not thinking about these types of questions and these things. And I think it's so important, you know, having a book like yours out there, it's like reminding people, like, you know, step back from the rat race and like focus on the things that are important.
Well, there are a couple of key insights you just touched on right there. One is when people say the meaning of life, no one bothers to define their terms and call me a nerdy scientist or whatever. But the first thing I did is, well, what do we mean by meaning of life? Because some people mean, I mean, there are so many different things you can mean. You can mean the cause of it, like the origin, aka is it the Big Bang or is it God? You could be talking about what's the ultimate point or goal that everyone should have, like what's the final, what's the end game? It could be the definition of life, like what defines it. It could be the intent or purpose of life. It could be the significance, what makes life significant. Those are all definitions of meaning. Mm-hmm. And so the one, again, like – there's one that's subjective, right? The goal is the subjective one, right? So that's the one where like everyone's going to have their own goals. So you can't answer that one. And that doesn't mean nihilists win and that there's no meaning. It just means that it's subjective to you. Yeah. Then the origin, I make the argument in the book, can we just set it aside? I don't know if you've ever heard of apatheism, but I kind of play apatheist here. Apatheist just means you don't care either way or you just say it's irrelevant. Yeah. So I'm just asking, like, can we all be apatheists just for a second and just set it aside and see what we can agree on, outside of whether the origin of life is or the universe is one thing or another, because you can't we can't answer that, because if it's a non-physical trigger, then you can't study that scientifically. So no scientist will ever agree with it, because you can't study non-physical using the study of the physical universe. It's impossible. So let's put that aside. But then what are you left with? It's like, well, you're left with definition, you're left with intent or purpose, you're left with significance, right? And you can prove those scientifically, right? The definition is freaking in the textbook, right? What are the attributes of life and growth or reproduction, or the drive is one of it. So growth satisfies that. It satisfies the intent, because I already mentioned with Darwin and the survival of the fittest, you actually have to have a drive to survive in order for the skill to actually freaking matter. And you, in terms of significance, when you think of who has awards given or recognition or statues or pick whatever form of like this person is the best at X. Why are they the best at X? Because they achieved more than anyone else achieved. Well, how did they get to that? Because they grew more than anyone else grew. They reached the highest points of their field. So growth satisfies the three that you could actually support scientifically, and it's the unifying theme that everyone can get. So there's a lot of cool stuff around defining your terms and making sure that that you're focused on the right things. But you're right, it is subjective. You're going to have your own goals. You're going to identify it. And the other cool thing you mentioned was that meaning will change over your lifetime. So it's not like I have the – like even take – let's take Peyton Manning. I mean, the guy like was raised a quarterback from day one, and the guy was a quarterback his whole life until his body gave out and he couldn't be a professional NFL top-tier quarterback anymore. So now what does he do? He doesn't just go, well, my life's over. I'm going to go, die now.
Take me to the back of the barn.
he goes and finds other things to do, because your meaning will change.
Yeah, exactly. And the same thing with all these athletes or people that have done something like TV personalities. They've done it for 20, 30 years, and it's like after that, they retire. Even actually just anybody, like a normal person who's had a job. Teachers come to mind as well. They've done teaching for 40, 50 years, and then they retire. It's like a lot of them feel like they're missing something, but they feel like they don't have a purpose anymore. And like, because that was their entire meaning of life was invested in that occupation, which is a big part of it, obviously, but you can't put everything in that basket. You gotta have more out there as well, like going on, and then you also have to have like the next thing that comes up. Like your life, as you mentioned a second ago, changes as different chapters and seasons come, or whatever you want to call it. It evolves over time, but you gotta have the next thing sort of lined up for you to be excited about, to have a purpose about, so you can then dedicate yourself to that. Because if you don't, that's where depression comes. That's where the suicidal ideations start to pop up. When you got literally nothing going on, you feel like your life's over, it's worthless. It's a terrible spot to be in, trust me. I know better than a lot of people.
Yeah, well, I had my own moments, as I mentioned, starting when I was six, wondering why. I literally said over and over again, I want to die. Like, I did not want to exist at that moment. It was horrible. So I totally get it. The thing that's interesting is that once – so you can understand, hey, growth through experience, and then your desires drive you, and that your beliefs sustain you, and then your emotions are giving you feedback. But the other ones really come in to help you have that meaning, not within a society, because you need to live with other organisms because we're a social species, but also they give you that sense of greater meaning. And you just hit on something I really like is a good segue to the ethics point. Ethics is number six. And what ethics is saying that you have to do things in the right way. And now look, the one thing I made sure in my book is that I don't recommend any of my personal beliefs. One of the things that drives me nuts about philosophy and self-help books and even religious texts is that people just start injecting their own ways of thinking onto people, like, well, yeah, you should, you know, should exercise 3 days a week, or you should do this, or, you know, you should, you know, don't eat meat on Fridays. So, like, whatever the rule is that, yeah, you know, the ethic that is that's there might be based on what that person thinks is best for everybody. But mm-hmm. the truth is that, like, look, there are some things like, hey, can we just agree not to hurt each other? Okay, that's a good one. You know, there's some good ethics that we should probably all follow in general. But I intentionally, when I write about ethics, I say, look, I'm not recommending any specific ethics. You can figure it out on your own. I'm just going to explain why ethics are key to meaning in life and generally what people agree on in terms of what good ethics are. And they're basically the secret to ethics is if you think about it, take a race or any kind of competition, and then turns out later the person who won cheated. And we've had a lot of examples of those recently, right? You know, through the performance enhancing drugs and so forth. Right. Remember I mentioned the definitions of meaning, significance and so forth. Think about that significance one, right? What makes something meaningful? If that person won, but it turns out they cheated, is it so significant or meaningful anymore that they won? No, it's gone. Now you don't want to put an asterisk next to their records and say, no, they're not really the champion. They're garbage or whatever.
Yeah.
So notice how – see, you can prove this scientifically either through – legitimately through the actual thing being the case, like drive to grow. Or you can prove it through psychological means where you test people's opinion, and everyone can kind of agree that if you cheat, it's not as cool or meaningful or significant or impactful or important as if you didn't cheat. So yeah. So that's why you need ethics. You have to have some sort of way to grow in the best way possible for yourself without hurting anybody else. And that's the only generic thing that I think everyone can kind of agree on. Maximize or optimize your own growth, trying to minimize your harm to other people.
Yeah, it's so important. And you're right, there's so many examples too, especially in the last decade or two. It's like the Barry Bondses of the world, Lance Armstrongs of the world, McGuire's of the world, Sosa. I mean, across the – and then you had, like, in boxing, you had people that, like, stuffed their gloves with I don't know what the hell it was, some kind of, like, plaster or something, like, and then they, you know, beat some – I think Antonio Margarito or Margarita, I forget his name, but he did that like a decade ago, and he got caught for that. But yeah, I mean, it just takes away the drive of what you're doing when you do those types of things, and takes away the victory when you actually get victory if it's spoiled that way. But I like also how you put it too, of people having beliefs in their belief systems and you not trying to, like, infringe on that, but just respecting that everybody's different. You know, same thing with politics, the same thing with religion, the same thing with I mean, anything in life where people believe different things. I think a big problem in our society right now is not only the censorship of different ideas, but also the suppressing and basically, I guess, discrimination against different ideas. Like, we all have different ideas, in my view, and this, I guess, is an idea that I have as well, an ethic, but I think it's a fair one, like some of the core like ethics that we should have. But it's like everybody should have the freedom to have their own ideas, their own beliefs, their own religion, political views, medical views, whatever, like across the board. I feel like that's such a big thing as a human being, to have the right to speak up and have your own ideas and beliefs, and like the suppression of other people's, or if you don't agree with, because there's a lot of people I don't agree with, but I always love hearing different sides, and I support and respect the fact that other people have different sides and beliefs. And I think that's one of the kind of big ones of, and I like how you put that, because you're not trying to, like, you know, impose upon others what your beliefs are, but you're putting it out there like, this is what I think, but you know, you can have yours as well. That's cool.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of books will say, here's what your goal should be. Or alternatively, they say, if your goal is this, here's what to do. Or they'll say, do these things. And I said neither of those things. I said, here's how to figure out what your goal is. Here's how to figure out what your ethics are. I'm going to step away and let you do that. I'm not going to tell you what I think. But what I will tell you, though, there are two good examples. You mentioned the one we were talking about, the cheating one and so forth. On the competition side, with regards to ethics, there were the two. The other one was the you were talking about, the people weren't allowed to discuss ideas. So there's an ethic. These aren't real terms. I just kind of made them up. But there are, I call them positive ethics and negative ethics. Negative ethics are don't harm people, and positive ethics are do this the right way to achieve the best outcome, right? And so I noticed that there's a way that people – that's what it is. There are ways that people do it. You'll notice. You'll see these tricks. You'll never be able to unsee these. So on the sports side, notice how people make excuses to keep the meaning high. So like Barry Bonds or Lance Armstrong or whomever, they'll say, oh, well, everyone was doing it. Or, if everyone's doing it, then it's not really bad. Or it wasn't as bad, didn't give them an advantage or whatever. Notice those things. They're trying to make it seem like it's not unethical, which keeps the meaning high. Mm-hmm. Because ethics can take away the meaning. It can also – they can sustain it by trying to make it ethical. And that's what gets down a slippery slope of, what do they call it? Moral relativity or something. Mm-hmm. The other thing is with regards to the people not letting other people speak is what happens is – so there are lines of ethics. I define them. The obvious one is physical harm. Right. So if I hurt you, you can prove that because you have a bruise or a cut or your face looks like someone pounded on it for a while. Like you can prove those things. But there's also like significant emotional or psychological harm. Right. Like if someone's stalking you or, someone's like, cyberbullying, like those are also harmful. You can't. It's harder to prove because can we prove that you are actually messed up from it? And even if we proved it was messed up, can you prove that that person did it when you don't have a direct cause? Like it's so much harder than physical, but you can still do it. It's still harm. We can all still agree that if you psychologically torture someone, then that's bad. But then there's the line of offense. And that's the line where you have to there's an ethic not to hurt people, but then there's also an ethic not to infringe on someone's rights. Rights are rights and laws are the two negative ways to enforce or set negative ethics. Right. Right. Like, hey, you have a right to bear arms, which means like if you infringe on my ability to carry a firearm to protect myself, then you are hurting me. And the same thing goes with like a law, like, hey, don't punch them in the face. Don't don't steal from them. So those are all pretty clear and obvious. But when it comes to offense, people start to get, well, look, if you're offended, you could just not be offended, right? You can walk away. No one's hurting you. So you're not actually hurt. People are acting hurt. But see, this is what people are doing. Notice the speech is violence, right? Like silence is violence. Basically what they're doing is they're taking something that's a positive ethic, like a way to speak, a way you carry yourself, a way you behave, and they're turning it into a negative ethic, which is you are hurting me if you act in a way that I don't like. And you see what they're doing. You'll never be able to unsee this. Every time that you see another one of those stupid taglines that say, that speech is violence, it's not. It's speech. Violence is violence. The speech is speech. And they're not the same thing, that people are turning it because they want you to think that their positive ethics of acting the way that they think is appropriate in society is a negative ethic so that they can turn it into a law, because most people generally believe that positive ethics should not be laws. We cannot set a law that says you must eat 3 servings of vegetables a day. That's absolutely insane. No one would go for that. But if you say, well, if you don't eat vegetables, then you're Hitler, then it's like, well, oh man, well, we didn't pass a law because we don't want, a bunch of non-vegetarian veggie-eating person to become Hitler, so therefore, got to eat your greens, It's ridiculous. So you'll see them do that. It's a trick. It's really bad.
Yeah, it's such a good point you make, man. And then I love that you kind of expose that truth of what's happening in our society, because you've seen it, especially the last 3, 4, 5 years of this PC culture, like we mentioned at the very beginning of the show, and just the evaporation of some civil liberties and rights that we have. And of course the rights come along with their own price, but the freedom of speech, I think, it's number one for a reason. It really is the most important one, having our ability to speak our minds and have our beliefs, have our ideas, and not be shut down or censored like we've been in the last like couple of years. But that's such a good, like, the ethic thing that you made, the point of how they can twist around the ethics of it. Like, say Barry Bonds can justify his cheating, and how they're, justifying their censorship and shutting people down, and then, it's offensive. It hurts. It's such a good point, though. I think that's a real good connection. We got to wrap up in a couple moments, but the last two, let's just touch on those real quick, and then so 7 and 8, I think, right?
So support is 7, and basically that just means if you want greater meaning. So everyone's like, well, Nate, what about greater meaning? Greater meaning, just if you see what it comes down to, it's just helping others and more than just yourself. That's literally all greater meaning is. Everyone thinks it's about you know, knowing some, you know, spiritual insight that no one else knows, what do you end up doing with that spiritual insight? You end up helping someone else. You end up, you know, teaching them, or you end up giving them food or whatever it is. You end up helping other people. You feel like you're contributing to something greater than yourself, and you feel greater meaning, period, full stop. That's what greater meaning is. So support is necessary to exponentially increase your growth and those of those around you. You can't build a pyramids by yourself or Stonehenge or whatever. You need more than one person, and it's only through support and cooperation that you succeed. So that's seven. And then I mentioned choice, but you have your own personal sense of agency, and the more you take control of yourself, there are tons of studies on this. My favorite one is the one where they took elderly people in elderly care centers, and they gave some of them plants. And they said, you're responsible for taking care of this plant. And they lived – I forget the exact name, so I'm going to estimate it was over a year longer, I believe. I don't remember that exactly. But they lived a year longer, and all they did was they had to take care of a plant. It was this idea that they – it had nothing to do with the plants and nothing to do – it was the responsibility / the agency. It was the idea that I have control over this plant. I have responsibility for this plant, because the ones who didn't have responsibility for the plant literally had responsibility for nothing, coming full circle in this conversation. No responsibility for you know, themselves, like kids who, you know, you could be 26 and still be on your parents' health plan or whatever. It's like you just have not had responsibility yet, and so you don't find that meaning. Same thing when you're elderly. When someone says, oh, and I saw this happen with my own grandmother. Everyone's trying to she loved work. She loved cooking. She loved doing laundry. She loved doing all this stuff. She loved all of that work. And they kept taking away from her when she got old enough. They're like, no, don't do that. I'll cook for you. I'll clean for you. I'll do this for you. She's like, she would just start screaming, I'm not an invalid. I'm not an invalid. I can do this. And they were sucking the meaning out of her life. And I could see it. And I'm just like, what's wrong with you people? Let her freaking do her laundry. Like, this is insane. Because yeah. When you take away everyone's responsibility, and that's what the world's trying to get. They're trying to make everything safer, and that's wonderful, but they're also not realizing it. They're trying to take away everybody's responsibility and the thrill and risk and all these other things that freedom give you, and that's a huge risk, and you see that in the scientific studies, that you need to have agency and choice and direct your own life. If you don't feel like you have that, and Daniel Pink with the whole autonomy, you have to feel like you have control over your own life, or you will not feel meaning in your life.
Just as a send-off takeaway message, what is like your meaning in your life and the things that you do on a day-to-day basis? I kind of don't want to ask this earlier and I sort of forgot, but I think it's a good way to wrap up. Like, yeah. What are the things that you do in your life to have the most meaning in your life? Like what is the meaning of life to you, and what are some of the things that you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, it's just applying those eight concepts. You just those eight concepts. You do them all, you cannot not have meaning. It's just impossible. It's like biologically impossible. or psychologically impossible, I should say, to be more accurate. But yeah, so I mean, what I do is just identify things I want to strive for. That's identifying what you want. Then identify how I want to grow in those areas. That's the growth. And then identify what I need to do to get there. So if it's writing a book, it's like, okay, I want a book. What does that look like? What do I have to do to get the software, I have to start writing this, so I have to create an outline, whatever it is. It's, you know, what's the right way to do it or the best way to do it? That's ethics. It's getting help, support, looking things up on the internet. It doesn't have to be real people. If you're not a people person, you can look things up on the internet. You can read. You don't need to, you know, ask everyone for all kinds of time. So support is more than just, you know, getting someone to help you. Then constantly looking at your emotions for feedback. Like, am I doing the right thing? Do I feel fulfilled when I do this? Am I excited about the future? Am I sad about the future? And your emotions will tell you about your beliefs and your desires as they relate to the experiences you're having. If you're feeling bad, then either your beliefs are bad, your desire, or your experience is bad relative to your desire. So that's a good signal. So you just really need to apply these principles. And that's what I try to do every day. If I don't feel good, I'm like, well, why don't I feel good? It's because I think this. Oh, I believe this. Okay, I got to change that belief and then I'll feel better. Do I have the support I need to grow? Okay, no, I don't. So let me go get that. Am I making choices, or do I feel kind of like helpless in my life? Oh, well, I'm not making the right choices. Okay, I got to fix that. So it's just a constant calibration of those eight areas that help you get that drive that you need. And for me, I got to tell you, publishing is hard. You know, writing a book. I mean, there are millions of books out there. I mean, you know, why buy mine? I don't know. But because I have good ideas, but like so does everyone else. So it's hard to say. But it's like, so I have to get up and go, okay, yes, you didn't, you know, sell a million books tomorrow or today, but you can try to get a little bit better the next day and the next day. So that's all you can do is just keep pushing and realizing that, look, if nothing happens in the exact way that you expected it to, it doesn't matter. You just keep moving forward, keep having those goals, keep using these eight concepts, and you'll definitely find that direction.
Love it, man. Great. I think it's a great send-off message. And what's the link, the website that you have for listeners to check out the book?
Sure. YourMeaningInLife.com is the name of the website. The book, The Meaning of Life, A Guide to Finding Your Life's Purpose, is on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all those sites. And then social media, I'm on. It's at Life the Book for many of them. I think one of them, I think like Instagram's like The Meaning of Life Book or something. But it's some derivation of either Life the Book or The Meaning of Life. We'll find my handle.
All right, cool. I'll figure it out and put them all in the show notes as well, so they just click on the link and get to the book, get to the social media pages. And yeah, man, I really appreciate your time. It's been an awesome interview. And I know our guys are going to love this one. So take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
All right, guys. I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I'd like you to do, and that's this. Subscribe to our podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast episodes and all of our world-class advice absolutely free. Subscribe now if you haven't already and become an Elite Man today. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an amazing review. We really do appreciate it.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.